Thanks. Hi. So it's kind of weird to be around people talking about this project, because for the first 6 months of it, it was just like me and a laptop in park grounds in Reynoldstown listening to people yell at their dogs, which was cool. But it's always exciting to see people share in the weird things that you like. So thank you guys all for coming. And Joe asked me to talk a little bit about sort of the genesis of this project, which I guess is kind of an interesting thing to undertake. But this started when I wrote a story for a website called The Billfold about how Flannery O'Connor talked about money in her letters, because she was real about making it. And I was trying to figure out what would be a good like portrait to go along with something like that. And my friend Alvin and I, who is one of the artists who contributed to the zine, whose work I'm about to read a piece on, thought it would be funny to do like a Cash Money record style portrait of her. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this, but it's this big rap label that in the 90s put out a lot of records, and like there was blinged out diamond borders and like gilded text and like enormous Hummers and anyway, you'll see an example in a minute. But we just thought, like, wouldn't that be a funny thing to do, make this portrait of Flannery O'Connor in this specific style? And unfortunately, we didn't have the time to make that happen for the piece that ran on the billfold. What we did have time for was this, which, I mean, that's also pretty good. And let me just, I've been practicing this in my bedroom mirror for a couple weeks now, so... So take that with you to the club later. So this was sort of the first iteration of the zine, honestly, which is why I'm showing it to you, other than it's also very silly and very funny. So that was sort of the first idea. And then I read this really great book of Flannery O'Connor's editorial illustration. She really wanted to be an editorial cartoonist before she wanted to become a novelist. And I was really struck by the fact that this woman was an incredibly gifted writer, obviously, very early on. But she also... really express herself visually very well, and so would it be even kind of more perfect and appropriate to do some sort of project involving her that involved visual arts? So that's kind of how it started, and I emailed a few friends at the end of last year and was like, hey, would you want to do this thing? And they were like, all right. And that's kind of how it went. A lot of the proceeds from this zine are going to the Andalusia Foundation, which if any of you are fans of Flannery O'Connor and you've not been to Milledgeville to visit Andalusia, oh boy, are you missing out? And you're about to be delighted by the possibilities of actually going to where Flannery O'Connor wrote the majority of her fiction. It's really a great space to visit, especially if you've got like a sandwich to eat for your lunch, because there's a really great like front porch, whatever. I'll tell you about it all later. So anyway, the first piece of the night is by Alvin Deek. Alvin, do you want to stand up and let people look at you? There's Alvin. And Alvin, yay! So the piece I'm going to read was inspired by Alvin's piece, this one right here. My favorite part of it is the blinged out crutch. It's perfect in every way. So here we go. I never believed nothing unless I got the money. 2 Chainz did not say that. Neither did RZA nor GZA. Method Man, Raekwon, Ghostface Killa, Inspecta Deck, U-God, Masta Killa, or Old Dirty Bastard, a.k.a. Dirt McGirt, a.k.a. Big Baby Jesus, a.k.a. R.I.P. Nope. These words were written by Flannery Stacks on Stacks O'Connor back in 1952 when her career was but a zygote, but her balls were the size of watermelons. She was real about getting paid. In her incredible book of letters, she writes about theology, literary theory, and life on her family's farm, but she also talks about the business of writing, and if you weren't talking money, she didn't want to talk. The uncompromising mind behind some of the last century's finest writing believed firmly in that mind's financial worth. Dollar, dollar, bills, y'all. O'Connor was savvy and bold from the start. When she was 25, she hadn't published anything beyond a handful of short stories, but she was already totally over her publisher, whose notes she found conventional. If they don't feel I am worth giving more money to and leaving alone, then they should let me go, she wrote. But just as her promising career was starting to take off, O'Connor was diagnosed with lupus, the disease that killed her father when she was 15. So she moved from the Northeast back to Andalusia, her family's farm in Milledgeville, where she raised peacocks and wrote the majority of her fiction. Specifics about O'Connor's financial history are tough to pin down, but she was not a pauper. She attended college and graduate school, and her family had enough wealth to buy Andalusia's 550 acres. But O'Connor's mother ran the farm as a working operation, which no one in the 1950s did for fun. When O'Connor won an $8,000 grant, she wrote to a friend that she intended to live for 10 years on that sum. O'Connor sold a lot of pieces to periodicals. "I hate articles, but I like money," she wrote. In 1961, a magazine paid her $750 for an essay about peacocks. That $750 payday is about $6,000 in 2014 money. "More than I have ever got for any piece of writing, by about half," she wrote. "Crime pays." O'Connor was a practical spender. After she sold the television rights for The Life You Save May Be Your Own, "It's certainly a painless way to make money," she said, she bought a Hot Point refrigerator that's still on display at Andalusia. O'Connor was not a fan of the eventual adaptation, which starred Gene Kelly, and her agent's secretary suggested that she approach Rodgers and Hammerstein about doing a musical adaptation, which would have been awesome, let's be real. In a letter, O'Connor suggested some lyrics. "The life you save may be your own. Hand me that there telephone. Heidi-ho and hip hooray. I am in this thang for pay." But O'Connor didn't hustle because she wanted expensive champagne, diamond-encrusted watches, or anything else you've ever seen featured on the cover of a Cash Money Records album cover. When she got a payday, O'Connor rarely splurged. "I never bought the record player," she wrote in a 1964 letter. "I saved up the money, and then I thought, this is a lot of money to spend up for something you don't already appreciate, and no guarantee that you ever will, so I ordered me a pair of swans instead." Money wasn't the most important thing in O'Connor's life. Catholicism ruled everything around her. But its value was clear. Lupus was expensive to treat. And this is conjecture on my part, but the same disease that she watched kill her father was killing her, which is the kind of thing that could make someone need to lose themselves in work. Money was necessary for her to continue her writing life. And that's a reason to chase paper, too. As her fame grew, O'Connor was increasingly asked to lecture at colleges and literary festivals, engagements she referred to as breadwinning expeditions. In letters to friends, she was open about her motives for the work. "I'm in terrible shape with the government. I made more money than usual one year, and the next year I had to talk at a lot of places to pay my income tax, which made me more money again, so I had to talk at a lot more places, which made me more, et cetera, et cetera. I'm poor as they come, and getting poorer, and income tax is getting higher every year, and I think this must end somewhere short of the penitentiary or the poorhouse." Flannery O'Connor was a groundbreaking writer of power who helped put Georgia and the South on the modern literary map. But let us also remember Mary Flannery O'Connor as Our Lady of Stacks on Stacks, as a woman who understood her value and expected others to act and pay accordingly. Reminder, women in the audience, on average, you make 77 cents for every dollar earned by your male counterparts. A good check is hard to find, even more so if you never demand it. Thank you. So our next reader is Johnny Drago. Yes, clap for him. Yes. He writes and plays short stories. He writes plays and short stories and has performed at Write Club Atlanta, Scene Missing Magazine, Vouch, True Story, any reading in Atlanta that's happened. Johnny's probably been there. So we'll have him come up right now. Johnny Drago, thank you so much. And I guess his piece is this one right here by Travis Eckmark, who I don't think is here, but come on up, Johnny. Sorry, that was awkward.
Awesome. Thank you to Brooke and to the Georgia Center for the Book and the Decatur Library and to Travis for making this really strange, really inspiring piece of art. The name of this is A Sacred Relic. The tour of the author's home, apart from some brief introductory remarks, was entirely self-guided and left much to be desired by way of liveliness. In making their pilgrimage, Ben Charles and good old Millie had hoped to gain a deeper sense of the author, to feel her presence by seeing her belongings up close, and thereby establish a proximity to her way of being not immediately appreciable from readings and rereadings of her stories alone. They had hoped to shrug off any academic or purely leisurely interest in her work and arrive instead at some idea of the woman herself. It didn't take them long to realize, though, that what they honestly felt in those generous, peeling rooms was next to nothing at all. What remained then, hanging like particles of red dust in the air, was an almost holy burden, made all the more urgent by an unspoken sense of expectation, perhaps of the author's second coming. Her personal possessions and furnishings were displayed lovingly for all to see, and with a thoughtful attention to accuracy of detail. Here were the living room curtains sewn decades ago by the author's mother. Here was her record collection, intriguing enough, but no touching allowed. And there, right there, leaning like a piece of gossip against the chiffon robe, were the crutches she had eventually used to get around the place. But these were objects, mere objects all, with no deeper meaning or animus whatsoever to be located there within. Having seen everything there was to see twice, Ben Charles and good old Millie resigned themselves to the disappointed conclusion that though they could easily imagine her at work here, morning after morning at the typewriter in her bedroom, they would neither smell nor taste anything substantial of the author that day. Anyhow, it was already 5 to 4, and whatever metaphorical or literal spirit of her they had hoped might whisper inspiration into their ears or brush past them on the staircase, leaving behind nothing more than a quickly fading patch of goose flesh or the barely perceptible swaying of a sheer curtain panel, was surely unlikely to do so, what with an irritable volunteer tapping her foot so aggressively from behind the register of the gift shop and clearing her throat and looking back and forth between the clock and then them and then the clock with exaggerated wide eyes. "Thank you very much," Ben Charles mumbled over his shoulder. Good old Millie said nothing, and they showed themselves out the front door. No sooner did it close behind them than they heard the lock turn over from inside with such force and finality as to make them wonder whether they had inadvertently trampled some priceless literary heirloom and might never be asked back or welcome again. They lingered on the front steps a minute, taking photographs of themselves and of each other with the cameras on their telephones, and trying to imagine a yard full of peacocks shrieking and strutting freely, if ambivalently, back and forth at their feet. "Mental hospital," Ben Charles proposed, and good old Millie nodded in concurrence. They got in the car and pulled out of the parking area and down the long country driveway that led to the author's home. The remainder of their afternoon was to be spent poking around the derelict remains of the state mental institution, at least until they were escorted off the premises by local law enforcement, or threatened by a lunatic with a shotgun, or chased by an angry foaming dog, whichever came first. In small-town Georgia, sometimes it's all three at once. A real live trinity of the most terrifying magnitude. They followed the interactive map on the dashboard of the car, and not long thereafter pulled into the big roundabout encircling like an asphalt moat the boarded-up red brick fortress of statewide speculation and lore, and stepped back out of the car. They snapped a few more pictures of themselves and of each other, and talked about looking for an accessible entry point to the building, which certainly must, they posited, be filled with the kind of energy and pulsating life their previous stop had so desperately lacked. Their talk was born of bravado, though, and mostly for show. Had they really been put to it, they would have stopped well shy of actually going inside, on account of mutual fear and practicality, and on account of the nearly new shoes they both had on. They walked around back of the building and smack dab into view of a hulking security guard who snapped his head and began waving his hands as he loped toward them across the yard, warding them off. While their hearts jumped up into their throats at the sudden appearance of him, he maintained the cool, unsurprised look of a man whose job it is to guard a place that proves equally attractive to vandals and teenagers making good on triple dog dares. "What are you folks up to, huh?" he called, drawing nearer. "Just looking around," Ben Charles offered, as good old Millie turned her gaze downward and drew a circle with her toe in the dirt. "A lot of people come up here just looking around," the guard said. "Very few find anything worth seeing except for the road right back home." He leaned in closer as if to better smell the quality of their characters. His eyes narrowed. "What kind of business you in?" While good old Millie said nothing and smiled broadly, Ben Charles immediately identified himself to the security guard as a writer and just as immediately regretted it. No other word in the language lent such an air of suspicion to his otherwise open and friendly face. He waited for the marching orders that inevitably followed such a careless admission. But the look on the hulking man's face didn't change in the usual direction of disdainful closing off. Rather, it seemed to raise like a window on a claustrophobic day, letting in a kind of breeze that spelled relief. "A rider?" he asked back. Ben Charles nodded and prepared the litany of stock answers he carried around in the knapsack of his mind, experience having prepared him for the litany of stock questions people eagerly asked about his troublesome vocation. But instead of saying, "What do you write?" or "Where do you get your ideas?" or the one that stung like a paper cut, worst of all, "What are you working on now?" The guard let out a full-bodied whistle from between his teeth, or between his jowl and jawbone, or from some other skillful country place that was not between his rounded lips, and then posed a question that neither Ben Charles's smooth talk nor good old Millie's studied silences could have anticipated. "Want to see something neat?" The guard said this so very much like a child with a pocket full of secret bullfrogs, at once innocently and yet touched by the thrill of danger, that Ben Charles and good old Millie didn't have to consult with one another on this matter at all. Of course they wanted to see something neat. One simply didn't drive a whole afternoon from the city into the country to see more and more concrete sameness. One closed such distances with the express, if unarticulated, intention of stumbling upon buried treasure. Practically everyone on this earth is holding their breath to see something neat, but only the brave ones say yes when that opportunity comes home to roost. The guard clicked his teeth and cocked his head and hunkered toward a heavy steel door on the basement level of the building. The two followed close behind him wordlessly, unwilling to look into one another's eyes for fear of breaking the spell of this man's confidence. Afraid one of them might prove chicken after all and run back to the car before either had gotten the chance to fully examine this fellow's idea of an obscure point of local interest. The man pulled approximately 300 jangling keys from his uniform, selected one of them almost without looking, and deftly undid the padlock on the door. He opened it and in a most considerate fashion held it wide for them to sidle past. Their eyes gradually adjusted to the half-shadow of this dank space, their noses to the stagnant, musty oxygen, and their ears to the dead silence enveloping them in the room with this stranger. As they looked around, Ben Charles saw stacks and stacks of file folders laid flat, presumably containing confidential patient records or other once-important documents now left to rot. Good old Millie noticed a beer calendar, yellowed and curly, on the wall, suggesting a thirsty, sunlit April, however many such Aprils ago. The man looked over his shoulder, now smiling broadly, eager to unburden himself, and only then did it occur to Ben Charles and good old Millie that perhaps they ought not to have followed this stranger back to his inner sanctum. Surely there were guns here, or handcuffs, or mace, or whatever a security guard requires to do his duty in such a thoroughly abandoned, isolated, and tantalizing place. "Don't ask me how this come into my possession, okay?" he warned. Ben Charles and good old Millie shook their heads dumbly, nearly unable to speak out of mounting fear and excitement. "All right, then," he continued, and knelt down before a wooden trunk piled high with faded, dusty magazines and memorabilia from another time. It occurred to Ben Charles how much the man in this moment resembled a priest, taking his place before a low altar, overcome with such veneration and conviction as to make his faith, or at least his faithfulness, entirely unassailable. The man removed the stacks of debris from atop the trunk and ceremoniously raised the lid. From inside, he lifted an object no bigger than a cabbage, wound about in heavy burlap. In one broad hand, he balanced the thing, holding it up for them to witness. With his other hand, he unwrapped the stiffened cloth, which cracked open and fell apart into feathery pieces between their feet. As Ben Charles and good old Millie stared and stared at the man's revelation with something akin to disbelief, the puzzle pieces of this insane thing began to sort themselves before their eyes. This was the head of the author. Of that, there could be no question. Here was her hair, once carefully rolled and set for eternal slumber, now hanging wildly and without restraint about her head, densely matted into thick curls in some places, worn off completely in others. Here were the frames of her glasses, unmistakable and signatory in their own way, however cracked or crunched over to one side they might have been. And there, right there, were the dark smudges of her lips, peeled back by dehydration to reveal that unmistakably measured, yet generous and quite sneaky grin. It was a gruesome sight, no two ways about it. But there was something altogether placid, too, about her face, something holy even. And together the three fell into a long, reverent silence. A fly, heavy and fat, beat its body against one of the hopelessly tiny basement windows, begging to be let out, but mostly given in to its own confinement. Ben Charles could have sworn that he saw the author's face sigh once, slowly and sadly, before snapping back to its original position of repose. This was the trick of the shadows, of course, as sighing takes lungs, and lungs take at bare minimum a torso to house and shelter them against the injuries of the world. When finally nothing remained between them to remain unspoken, the guard raised the author's head ritualistically to his lips, as one might do a chalice filled with wine, and without so much as a glimmer of shame or self-consciousness to color his heavy face, he planted a single kiss on the author's forehead. Then, before another second passed, which might could fill itself up with doubt or horror, he lifted the sacramental thing to their lips, and in turn, one after the other, Ben Charles and good old Millie planted their own little kisses on the detached head of the great woman. They both blinked hard and swallowed, and the guard covered the face again with honor and respect and limitless humanity before turning back to the trunk and delicately replacing it. "Don't ask me how this come into my possession, okay?" he repeated again. But his question was greeted only by the slamming echo of the steel door behind him. Ben Charles and good old Millie were gone in a flash, and so was the fly, having seized its own chance at fresh air and freedom. And once the sound of their car speeding away down the road tapered off in the distance, the guard made the sign of the cross where he still knelt and kissed his closed fist and blessed the name of the author for the 100,000th time in his life. As Ben Charles and good old Millie raced back to the city, to safety, to the familiar, they saw fit not to speak or even turn on the radio, drifting instead loosely in their own thoughts. Ben Charles considered the time when he was 10 years old at his grandmother's funeral and how his mother had forced him to look at the body despite his wishes, thinking it might hurry along the boy's acceptance of the new world in which they all now lived, still together but lonelier by one. He considered the peculiar Catholic tradition of keeping the bones or fingernails or the scrap of a garment of a saint contained like a private benediction beneath the church's altar. He considered the enormous act of faith required to accept beyond a doubt the notion of transubstantiation of word into flesh and flesh into food. And good old Millie, watching the familiar landscape burst to life with the color green as it rolled past her in the window, secretly dabbed her tongue at the inside corners of her mouth, unsure of whether to spit and scream at the strange flavor on her lips, or to close her eyes as if in prayer and quietly savor the earthy taste of the author that still clung there.
My word, that was amazing. Thank you, Johnny. So our next reader is Jared Dawson, who will be reading a piece on this by an illustrator named Emily Wallace, who is in North Carolina and is not able to join us, unfortunately. But let me tell you about Jared, who is here to join us. Jared Dawson is a dinosaur wrangler, the cousin of black magic, and a ghost on the internet. Jared Dawson, thank you.
So, true confession, I meant to send Brooke a different name, and I assumed that there wouldn't actually be any visual evidence of what we were working on, so let's just go with a loose interpretation by this picture. You say poison like it's a bad thing. One. His bedroom windows are set high in the eastern wall, and he has no curtains or blinds, and does not mind when the morning sun pours through the glass and wakes him. I have seen 1,000 faces in 1,000 lights. My mother's in the glow from the bulb over the stove. Another in the wash of the TV static and Christmas lights from the living room tree. The rectangle pouring from the open refrigerator door, and the last burst from a setting sun that slides in low through the air, surprising what it hits. 1,000,000 lights filling the space between my face and that one. Distance is the space between my last word and your next one. Distance is the arc this knife will travel as it explores around your neck. Two. He moves among the chickens. He wears jeans, a white V-neck undershirt, and brown cowboy boots. The hens protest his presence with the din of their collected clamor, a jerking, roiling mass of brown feathers, beaks, and stuttering feet, punctuated here and then there with the lustrous gleam of a dark eye peering between the action to catch his. And he leans down to catch the chickens by the neck, and he rolls his hand in a sudden flick, barely registering the dull snap of the vertebrae, the heave of the soft body as the life abruptly dissipates. Not lost in the languid motion from the veins or snuffed in the entrapment of the lungs, but like a brief flash. A firefly's lamp deep in a clump of weeds, there and then the next moment, lost. Life is different than you think. He sets them in piles of 25. He sets 10 piles of 25. His wrists hurt, the dull ache spreading back from the heel of his palm to his elbow, brightened every now and then by a shock of pain. He sits in the grass away from the chicken house and the 10 piles of 25. His shirt sticks to the sweat that spreads across his broad chest. The stains deepen. The sun stands overhead, and he has been working since this morning. You say poison like it's a bad thing. It will be all life a struggle with no consummation. When something is finished, it cannot be possessed. Nothing can be possessed but the struggle. All our lives are consumed in possessing struggle, but only when the struggle is cherished and directed to a final consummation outside of this life is it of any value. Life is different than you think. Three. You chop the vegetables and put them in the soup. You chop the vegetables and put them in the soup. You have done this before, and you will do it 100 times more. You will make piles of 25. You will make 10 piles of 25. You say poison like it's a bad thing. You say suffering, and there's a sting in your voice. I say lean. Lean in and catch the chickens by the neck.
So our next reader is Nicholas Tokoski, who's going to be reading about this one, I think. Nicholas, where are you? So Nicholas Tokoski is the Viceroy of Write Club Atlanta and does lots of other awesome literary things around town. So come on down, Nick.
Thanks, Brooke. This is called The Throat You Slit, maybe your own. He crossed from the west and reached the other side to discover their eyes already on him. The old woman had her hand up in an attempt to blot out the whole of the setting sun and focus on his form, black and spindly in silhouette. She squinted, her eyes near disappearing into the folds of her face. The young girl didn't shade her eyes. She leaned forward, hands on the splintered porch rail, and stared straight at him. He'd surprised them, crossing at the moment when the sunset would be at its most spectacular. He'd appeared as if hatched from a full-grown, great, flaming egg. Crossing into this dreary world on a long, shining threshold of silver, his long, cocky strides telegraphing his inherent superiority over his environs. He turned theatrically and regarded the sky behind him, felt the warmth wash over his face. He slowly raised his appendages, one twisted, broken, shorter than the other, and, from the perspective of the old woman, he resembled nothing so much as a crooked, feather-covered cross. And then the rooster turned and made his way to the porch, where the old woman was already sitting back, having had her fill of spectacle. She quietly wondered what color his feathers were underneath the layers of brown, red clay and black dirt. "Evening," she said.
"Lady," he said in a deep velvet tone, "I'd give a fortune to live where I could see that every evening."
"Well, it does it every evening," the old woman said, and no more. He looked toward the young girl and gave her a sly wink. She simply stared back, clear blue eyes wide, taking in every inch of him. He shifted uncomfortably under her gaze. It was a gaze of an innocent, simple, straightforward, but more. She looked at him as though she could see something in him that he had not noticed was there. It made him shudder. He quickly turned his eyes to the property, the pump near the corner, the fig tree, the broken-down chicken coop on the other end of the yard. The chickens, 14 of them, sturdy hens, fat, poking for grubs in the dirt. His eyes lingered on them for a moment before the old woman spoke up. "You got yourself a name?" He snapped to, and the smile, such as it was, returned to his face.
"Well, yes, ma'am, I reckon I do."
He puffed up his filthy breast.
"In this wide world, they call me Foghorn Leghorn."
"I'm pleased to meet you," the woman said. "Name, Lucy Carter, and daughter, Lucinell Carter. Where are you from, Mr. Leghorn?"
Roundabouts.
His eyes wandered once more to the ruins of the coop.
"Lady," he continued, "there ain't a broken thing on this plantation I couldn't fix for you, janky wing or not. I say, I wouldn't even need no payment, just meals and the sunset. I could sleep in that old chicken coop once I got her fixed up."
She regarded the coop thoughtfully. "My husband built that coop back in 28. We're in the egg selling business. That coop was all we had. Day he died, a great wind came up and knocked it over. Now the hens just got to sleep in the fig tree. Shame, too. It was a good coop. They don't build coops like that no more." He nodded, as if this were some sage wisdom.
"Ain't nothing like it used to be, lady. His world is almost rotten."
She turned her small eyes back on him. "You want an omelet, Mr. Leghorn? Best in the county." Within weeks, the dusty farm was greatly renewed. The woman woke in the mornings to hear Leghorn singing loudly to the sun through the hammer handle in his beak as he patched the fence or the roof overhead, as he fixed the water pump, as he lovingly, almost obsessively, restored the great coop to its former glory, as her mute daughter watched on. He traveled with them to market to sell their eggs, expertly balancing the crates on his good wing while sturdying it with the other. He took his meals on the porch, mostly omelets, and hummed Camptown Races quietly to himself. And when the woman turned in for the night, he wandered the grounds restless, as if stillness weren't something he was accustomed to. One night, pacing, he thoughtlessly gazed into the window of the girl's bedroom and caught her in the blue nightgown, kneeled down beside her bed. She prayed wordlessly, furiously, sweat on her brow. He wondered idly what exactly it was she prayed so hard for. The answer came quickly when her eyes snapped open and somehow found his in the darkness. A smile spread across her face as she crossed herself slowly. Without taking her eyes from him, she reached over and extinguished her lantern, leaving him alone in the starless night to deal with an unnameable dread. He skulked back to the quiet clucks coming from inside the chicken coop. He woke late the next morning from a strange dream to cold water being poured across his breast. He sat up with a start to find the girl there, half undressed, caked to her arms with brown black muck, clutching a sponge in one hand and a bucket in the other. She smiled knowingly at him.
He looked down to find his body clean, white feathers smelling of lye soap. He gawked at them. It had been so long since he'd last seen what was underneath the layers of filth that his long travels had applied to him, and he almost didn't recognize his plumage for his own. The bucket dropped, and she moved toward him. Her eyes still so blue and clear, but something moving in them, something beneath the surface, a hunger. "Now hold on," he said in a whisper. The hen scattered as she leapt on him, pressing her hot mouth to his rough beak, pulling at his coxcomb painfully, her body twisting and grinding atop his own. He wrestled her off and bolted out of the coop and into the yard, where the old woman stood on the porch, an axe clutched in one hand, a broken egg in the other. Her face twisted, as if it couldn't decide between confusion and rage. She held the egg up. "Explain this, Mr. Leghorn, and quick." Inside the shell, a small form buried in the middle of the yolk. So small. Slowly he looked back up to her face, unable to speak. "What have you been doing inside that them coop all them nights, Mr. Leghorn?" It was at this moment that the girl burst out of the coop, wordlessly bleeding for him to return. He looked at her. He looked at the hens in the yard, pecking the dirt. When he looked back to the old woman to explain, he was met with the sharp edge of the axe head. And then he was looking at the brown-black dirt, at the feet of the two women, the hens, at his own body running madly away across the yard, past the pump, the old porch, and back toward the road, trying desperately to get to the other side. Thank you.
So I neglected to mention, and if you are literate, you can tell, this was done by Elizabeth McNair, who's also in the audience. I'm sorry, Elizabeth. Everyone needs to know that you're cool and that you're here. So Elizabeth is back there. Let's all give her a hand. And there was an earlier draft of this image that didn't contain the blood. And then Elizabeth was like, here's a new version with some blood. And I'm glad that happened. Thank you for that, Elizabeth. So our next reader is Amy Pence, who has authored the poetry collections Armor, Amour, and The Decadent Lovely. She recently won the Claire Keyes Poetry Award from the literary journal Soundings East. In addition to poetry publications in a variety of journals, she's also published interviews, reviews, and essays in The Rumpus, The Conversant, Colorado Review, Poets and Writers, and the Writers Chronicle, among others. She teaches in Atlanta, Georgia, and lives in Carrollton, and she will be reading a piece loosely inspired by this one, which is done by Rebecca Bowen, who's standing right back there. Say hi, Rebecca. So, Amy, come on up. While Amy's walking up here, I'll tell you guys a little nerdy history on this image. Flannery O'Connor did have one kind of boyfriend. He was a book salesman. He would come into town, and they would drive around in his car. So this image is actually Flannery in his car, which I think is kind of a neat story. So anyway, here's Amy.
I have to adjust this down quite a bit. Not as tall as you guys. So I wanted to thank Brooke for having me, and I love this image here of Flannery. So great that the artist is here. I also want to thank Christopher Martin, who published the poem in his beautiful online journal, Flycatcher. I don't know if you all have seen it yet, but it's very nice. And just a little more of the story about the poem that I'm going to read for you is that I did visit Andalusia twice. The first time I got there too late, and I'm really sorry that I did not meet that security guard. But the second time, I did meet Elizabeth Wiley, who's the executive director now of Andalusia. And she helped me actually end this poem with some of her remarks about Flannery O'Connor. She said that she suggested that, you know, Flannery's awareness of her impending death really helped her focus powerfully on those stories, those last stories that she wrote. And in those that beautiful progeny of, you know, of her work. So I just, you know, felt like it's that awareness that all of our artists, we should all feel that so that we can create. So this is called Flocking the Flannery. We've arrived too late for Andalusia. Peafowl huddle in their coop. Tail feathers folded as if the sudden collapse of grandeur were our mistake. We've come for our Flannery, carry her complete stories, tromp down to Tobler Creek, garbed in southern goth, knee socks pulled high, bangs straight. But the O'Connor is locked, screen door shut, rockers stilled. We've wandered far inside the Flannery, but cannot find her, red-faced Mary, head in a book, wishing herself 12 forever. We harbor our grotesques, fondle them with relish, our mothers like hers, holding the secret, our death. She'll betray us once, then twice, but never to our bland faces. We are obtruded by the Flannery, redolent spread magnolias, fossilized our favors, fitful and incomplete. We hold out our pea-greenish handbags, die in obscurity, obscured by the Flannery, writing fiendishly in death's spread tail feathers, full-blown, fisted in our fatalistic south. Thanks.
Thank you so much for that wonderful poem. And now we're to our last reader, who will be writing about, or who will be reading a piece inspired by this. Yunhua isn't here, but that is her dog, Bruce Pugstein, the cutest. And he is. But our next reader, last reader, is Laura Relier. She's a writer in Atlanta and the managing editor of Scout Mob and the editor-in-chief of Vouched Books. So, Laura, come on down. I feel like the price is right.
Can we give another round of applause for Brooke for putting this all together and all of us? I've been obsessed with this illustration since it happened, as I share an affinity for Flannery O'Connor, smushy-faced dogs, and Bruce Springsteen. So, okay, this is called Did You Save the Dog or Did the Dog Save You? The old woman and her dog were sitting on the front porch when the contractor's truck rolled up along the long gravel driveway for the first time. The afternoon sun was high and glared off the white Ford F-150 so that the old woman raised her hand to shield her eyes as he approached. A Brooks and Dunn song blared out of his open windows. The dog panted heavy in the heat, pausing only to lick its front paws a few times. The old woman lived alone in the house with her dog. Her son and his family had moved all the way to Florida some time ago. Her daughter lived in Atlanta. Years had passed since she last had company, but she could tell from the way the contractor moseyed up to the house, his sports sunglasses, his slight limp, his cell phone hitched to the waist of his Wrangler jeans, that he was a good countryman and no one to be afraid of. The woman didn't stand until he was to her fence, but then struggled to do so. It was then that the man caught the dog's attention, and it began to hoot and howl, running in circles beside the woman's fading white rocking chair, its thick nails scratching terribly on the worn and fading wood of the front porch. The dog was a confused mutt, slightly overweight and low to the ground like a hound, but with the wiry brown hair of a terrier and one ear that stood on end. The contractor stayed outside of the gate in the front yard and took off his sunglasses and ignored the dog's conniption. He was mostly bald up top, but had a long gray and blonde ponytail that went down his back and a beard to match it, which made his square jawline even more pronounced. The woman estimated he was in his late 40s or so, but the older she got, the worse she became at estimating age. "Good afternoon, ma'am," he said. "Is this the..." He looked down at a clipboard he carried. "Is this the Nell residence?" She looked at him for a long time before responding. "It is. I'm Lucy Nell. This is my dog, June." The dog had stopped barking and its tail wagged vigorously. "I suspect Bailey called you to fix up the house a bit." "Yes, ma'am. My name is Aaron Sparks of Sparks Contracting Services here in Milledgeville." He took a moment to study the facade of the home, which was cracked and leaning in inauspicious places, the toll of decades of aggressive summer's humidity and haphazard home ownership. He could tell that the carpenter bees had gotten the best of the front porch already and that many of the windows would need to be replaced. The roof, too, needed some work, though he suspected that Mrs. Nell and her son didn't have that in the budget. "Your son arranged for me to come by and make an estimate on some necessary home repairs before you all put the house on the market? He says you're coming to join him in Florida soon." The woman huffed. "I don't want to go to Florida," she stated firmly. "Too many criminals loose." But my son says I'm too old to live here alone anymore and plans to coop me up in one of those retirement communities till I die. I tell him I'm not alone. I've got June here with me, but he don't pay her no mind. She shuffled down towards the gate and opened it for him, her cotton floral nightgown still on and faded, her slippers on as well. It's not as if he makes the trek up here to see me anyway. They walked up to the house together. I see, ma'am. Well, he's just asked me to look around today and make some estimates, and then I'll talk it over with him, and me and my men will come by and fix everything up. He walked to the house with her. To be honest, ma'am, I don't blame you for not wanting to leave. I'd give just about anything to live in a place like this. Well, that's kind, the old woman said, and made her way into the kitchen and sat down at a four-top chrome-craft table. Take a look around, see what needs touching up. June and I don't mind. And with that, Mr. Sparks passed a scrutinizing look over every inch of the house, the plumbing behind its three sinks, the splintered linoleum on the kitchen floor, the warped wood paneling in the master bedroom. The dog followed him from room to room, its heavy padded feet scratching the aged hardwoods every step of the way, tail wagging hard. When Mr. Sparks bent down to inspect some loose wiring near an electrical outlet, the dog licked his face aggressively until he had to push her away. When he was finished, he made his way back to the kitchen, where Mrs. Nell was sitting with a glass of tap water at the table right where he had left her. His phone rang. He silenced it. Well, ma'am, you got a fine home. I'll be getting along. We'll be in touch soon. He took out a pack of cigarettes and a lighter from his back pocket and made his way out the front door. The dog barked and howled strangely, blocking his steps and tripping him all the way to the gate. Over the course of the next month, Mr. Sparks and his men went about making their repairs to Mrs. Nell's home. Her son had tasked them with mostly cosmetic duties, new paint, windows replaced, things that would entice buyers. Passing inspections seemed to be the least of the son's concerns, but Mr. Sparks was an honest man, and Mrs. Nell and her dog were kind enough that often enough he would stay along after sending his men home and see about extra things himself off the clock. He re-poured the concrete on the front steps and power washed just about the whole house. One Sunday, he even replaced the hot water heater with a discarded but still functioning one from another job site. That evening, the sun seemed to linger long and heavy over the branches of the magnolia tree in the front yard as if it were to nest. Mr. Sparks remarked that he was happy to have never spent much time outside the world beyond Milledgeville. He had been reared here and raised here, and he didn't see a reason to leave a place where even the sun wanted to linger. "Do you have a dog?" the old woman asked. Mr. Sparks let the question hang there and lit himself a cigarette. Ma'am, if I had a dog, I don't imagine I'd be able to stay here so late in the evenings to attend to things. A man gives up his liberty when he commits to things like dogs and wives and families, and I respect men with that kind of fortitude, but I've known for some time that it's not the way things work for me. I'm a man of few obligations, and I intend to keep it that way. June, of course, was laying at his feet the whole time he spoke, her tail batting at the grass, and she had been diligently following him around for the bulk of his afternoons as he made repairs. She was there waiting for him and his men at the mouth of the crawl space each time they went to fetch a new pail of gravel as they lined it. "Is June your first dog, ma'am?" "My one and only, and she's the best dog a woman could hope for. I couldn't give her up for anything on earth. She may not look like much, but she certainly manages to keep the vermin and the vagrants at bay, and she's great company even with her howling fits. I wouldn't give her up for all the money in the world." "She's right where she belongs then, right by your side, ma'am. Any man that tries to separate us can go straight to hell." "I suppose you're justified in saying that, ma'am, though if he were honest, her vulgarity made him a little bit uncomfortable. As always, that evening, June followed him all the way to the gate. The next morning, he and his men started work on their final task, fixing a bit of the shingling on the roof, which really needed to be completely redone, but despite his best efforts to strike Bailey and Mrs. Nell a deal, they simply wouldn't have it. The dog shadowed him around the perimeter of the roof from the ground below with diligence, barking and rolling around on its back in the grass. Mr. Sparks wished that Mrs. Mell would come and fetch her, bring her inside, but he could hear the hum of her aged voice arguing on the phone with Bailey below. He decided it was best to let it lie and let June stay where she was. 20 minutes later, Mrs. Nell emerged from the house, puffy-faced and riled up. The dog barked alongside her. They really were quite the pair. "Mr. Sparks, I'm going to need you to come in and see me about something before you leave today." She braced the sun from her eyes as she spoke, gazing up at him on the roof. He looked down at her, hammer in hand. "Sure thing, Mrs. Nell. I'll come find you." "Right. Be safe." June stayed at the foot of his ladder, waiting. At the end of the workday, Mr. Sparks and Mrs. Nell sat inside the house at the kitchen table after he sent his men home for the day. They shared pleasantries over ice water, discussed the way time changed and people didn't, but then after a while, Mrs. Nell grew restless. "How many more days of work you got in the house, Mr. Sparks?" "Probably a couple of days, ma'am, at most." He shifted his weight in the chair. "We'll do it right." She shifted her glance to June, who laid between them on the feet. "See that dog there, Mr. Sparks?" He shook his head, yes. "Well, it seems my son found a retirement home for me, Mr. Sparks, but not for old June here. They won't let me keep her with me, and he says he can't afford a spot that will allow pets. I'm in a bit of a pickle, and I see only one solution." She looked at him plainly. He adjusted his throat. "What do you suppose that solution is, Mrs. Nell?" "Mr. Sparks, you've got to take June with you when you finish up. I'll give you the money for food and her bowl and her leash and everything she needs, but I can't trust her to anyone else, and Bailey tells me I can't bring her with me." He stood up from his chair. "I told you before, ma'am, I can't have a dog right now, and I don't want one. It takes money and time, and I've got not much of either right now. I'll give you money." "I can't take your money, ma'am, and that's besides the point. A dog needs attention and affection. Some people will do anything anyhow nowadays, but in my mind, a man should only take on what he's got for the time and energy for, and the only time and energy I got these days is for myself. If I had a dog, I'd want a yard to let its hair up in, a nice air-conditioned home to retreat to, sidewalks to walk it along in the evenings. I've got none of those things, and it just ain't right. June's a fine dog, but there are finer owners out there for her, ma'am." "June hasn't gone on a single walk for the decade that I have owned her. And the most she's torn up any yard is what she's done following you around here these past few weeks. You can take her to work with you. You'll barely notice she's there. It ain't right for a man to be as alone in the world as you are. You need a dog, and I'm giving you mine. I'm always on the move. It ain't right. Listen, Mr. Sparks, she's never taken to anyone as well as she's taken to you. The fact of the matter is, I don't trust her to anyone else, and this is simply the way it has to be. You're a dog owner now. Get used to it." He left without responding, lit himself a cigarette, swearing underneath his bated breath. The roofing progressed more quickly than Mr. Sparks had anticipated, and he and his men wrapped up by the end of the next day. Mrs. Nell had already packed the remainder of June's food, along with her leash, collar, papers, and bowl, into a canvas bag and placed it on the floorboard of the passenger seat of his Ford by the time he came down from the roof. June struggled into the passenger seat next to him, head panting out the window. "Doesn't she look happy as a clam?" Mrs. Nell remarked, patting the dog on the head one last time. "Makes me glad to know she's going with someone who's trustworthy. Bailey's come down to fetch me first thing tomorrow and meet with the realtor, and then I suppose I'll be headed to Florida with all the vagrants." She kissed the dog on the forehead and climbed in the driver's seat. I wish I could hide you in the car with me, June." She looked up at Mr. Sparks. "Thank you for looking after her." He looked away. "I wouldn't let any other man have her but you. I know you. You're a good man." He began to ease the car out of the driveway. The evening was clear and vibrant, and June and Mr. Sparks were engulfed by the bright scarlet sunset. They headed back into town for a moment. Mr. Sparks even forgot he had June with her, but she was so quiet and content with her head out the passenger side window, her lopsided ears flagging in the wind. Occasionally he gazed at her in the seat beside him, but mostly he kept his eyes on the road. He'd had a long day at work and didn't feel like cooking when he got home, so he stopped in the front of an aluminum-painted barbecue stop on the edge of town, about 15 miles or so from his home. He tied June up to a pillar about 10 feet from the door and went inside and ordered himself a pulled pork sandwich and some mac and cheese. She carried on whining for several minutes before wearing herself out and laying down, resting her head on the porch. The sun was low now. There was no one in the restaurant save for Mr. Sparks and the waiter. Whenever Mr. Sparks moved his eyes in the direction of the dog, her tail began to wag, even when her eyes were closed. "They call him man's best friend for a good reason," the waiter peered out the window as he refilled Mr. Sparks' iced tea. "It's like they can feel you, and they send all the love in the world right back without hesitation," he murmured. "She's astray. Found her on the side of the road," Mr. Sparks said. "Can't bring her home with me. Landlord don't allow pets." The waiter looked down at Mr. Sparks and back to the dog before walking to the kitchen. Mr. Sparks left the necessary cash on the table for his dinner and left, leaving June tied to the banister. He didn't even look back at her in the rear view as he drove away. The evening grew dark, and he was feeling more depressed than he ever had, selfish and cruel. He drove straight past his own home and into the night. The air was thick and heated. The late hours brought no cool relief, but he kept the windows down. He could see in the rear view a storm was brewing, slowly but surely. He felt very badly he wanted company and considered turning the car back around to the diner, but his pride got in the way, and he continued into the night. He passed only a handful of cars, a couple of beat-up old Buicks, and a newer Chevy with a bumper sticker on the rear. Did you save the dog, or did the dog save you? He moved his eyes back to the road. 5 miles off, he saw the white, low figure hobbling around the edge of the highway, a muscular pit mix, three-legged, cutting its way through the untamed grass. Mr. Sparks regarded the distant flash of lightning in his rearview mirror and slowed the car down and stopped along the edge of the highway. The dog walked right up to him and licked his outstretched hand, tail wagging in frenetic circles. I suppose you could use some shelter for the night. Let's take a look at your collar. The leather bore no number, but just a name and the bone-shaped tag, Misfit. The dog climbed into the passenger seat without a yap or much protest. It curled right up and fell straight to sleep. You must have been out there for a while, huh? He turned the truck around and headed toward home. Mr. Sparks felt oppressed. Misfit, he said after a minute. The dog thumped its tail once in acknowledgement, kept its eyes closed. I had a dog of my own once, too. I suppose they call you man's best friend for a reason. The dog didn't move. The road was long and flat ahead of him. After some time, Mr. Sparks grew unnerved by the animal's complacence. It didn't seem right for a dog to stay that still in a moving vehicle with the window down. June's head had been out the passenger side the entire drive to the diner. He loosened his grip from the gear shift and extended it towards the dog and rested it on his lower hip. The dog let out a low and rumble of a growl. Now there, pup. I'm just trying to show you some comfort. The dog looked at him and continued to whine. You just be quiet. Why not stick your head out the window for a bit? Enjoy the air. In an instant, the dog was on his hand, clamping down hard. Mr. Sparks howled and let go of the wheel to push off the dog, but the harder he fought, the harder its grip, and they fell together with the truck into the ditch. The dog hobbled out of the window and went along the road. Mr. Sparks stayed, cradling his right hand in his left arm. It pulsed with throbbing heat. At least a few bones were broken, he could tell, and he bled heavily. It wasn't long before the sky opened up. Heavy drops of rain walloped against the crushed white pane of his Ford. He heard the harrowing peal of thunder in the distance. Mr. Sparks removed his shirt and bandaged his swollen hand with it, but otherwise stayed still and let the world come at him. Thank you.
Pretty perfect note to end it on, a broken man in the ditch. So I want to thank again all of our readers tonight. You guys have been impressive. That was such a great night of reading. And also, thank you to the Georgia Center for the Book for hosting such an occasion. Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much for coming. I really appreciate it.